morning. My name is Ralph Wilmoth, and I'm the STI and HIV section chief at the Colorado Department of Public Health, and I am not an epidemiologist, as you will see from my presentation. So I'm going to spend a little time talking about our program and our issues that we wanted to address, and then we'll get to a couple maps at the end, and I'll talk about how we're using those maps in Colorado. In Colorado, right from the beginning of the identification of HIV and AIDS, we determined that that was a sexually transmitted infection and should be incorporated in our program. And so we've never known it any differently. And in our environment, our section includes surveillance. So our surveillance activities are separated out from our other communicable disease surveillance activities. We have our partner services that's all integrated program. Our DIS don't know that you aren't supposed to just do interviews of whoever has these sexually transmitted infections. So they just take that in stride. Our care and treatment, both our Ryan White funded care and treatment and our state funded care and treatment, is all incorporated right in our program. And we have a lot of administrative activities that covers a lot of area, including all of our prevention, and we have a prevention training center there as well. So we were the first state that required name-based reporting, and it started in August of 1985, and so we have a very robust and a very well-established surveillance program there with a lot of very healthy and consistent data. Our data sets are very dependable, and we've developed them well. The Board of Health in 1993 required that all CD4 counts would be reported as well. Well, that's not quite true. You can see exactly how it's worded here, and I'll address that in a couple of minutes. We initiated partner services for HIV in 1986, and as I said, it's just part of our program. It's handled exactly like syphilis partner services, no different, with the notable exception that there's more referral that occurs around those interactions. And we started what we call our 911 project, and that's kind of a the term implies two different things completely. It's a code we use, but it also is exactly what you would think with 911. It means it's an urgent situation that we need to respond to quickly around HIV. And I'll describe that a little bit more. In the last couple years, we've done a couple different things that have reinforced our program. One of them is that while we required syphilis serologies on all pregnant women in the state of Colorado, we didn't require HIV testing. And now we've implemented opt-out HIV testing. We followed that up with a revision of our State Board of Health rules that they just passed last month that included all viral load tests to be reported, regardless of the outcome. There's only one reason to do a viral load test, and that's because you think the person's infected. We had some large laboratories that were using that as a way of not reporting, and that didn't help us. We made some other changes too, and I just want to note this since we're at an STD conference. Chlamydia was not reportable by providers in Colorado until the rules will actually come into effect in April. Colorado was the only state in the union that chlamydia wasn't reportable by a provider. That will change, and hepatitis C is now being identified as a sexually transmitted infection, and that's a big change. So in Colorado, the reportable STIs are gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, hepatitis, and HIV, but we have a separate law for HIV, as many of you do. Just a little bit of the background here. We had about 9,600 reported AIDS cases as of 2009, and 6,500 reported HIV not AIDS cases. And we separate them out that way. Our morbidity around syphilis and HIV is very similar, and so many of these numbers, when this is all going to be about HIV, but you can think syphilis as well, because it's the same affected populations. So the majority are in males, the majority is men who have sex with men, and we do have some IDU transmission and some crossover between the two. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with each of those. Those of you that aren't familiar with HIV programs or as familiar, we have several different ways that we identify new cases. One of them is the serologic testing algorithm for recent HIV seroconversion, or because we love acronyms, STARS testing. And we use a series of two tests. This is not diagnostic testing. but it is to identify or determine, based on this algorithm, whether a person is likely to be a new infection. This slide talks about that it's specifically developed for this purpose, not diagnostic and not clinical. We also have done some acute infection testing. We had a pooling project, a NAT project, Nucleic Acid Amplification Test Project. I'm trying to break myself saying testing after that because the T is for testing. We ran that for about a year and a half and were successful at identifying some very new undetectable HIV infections. Unfortunately, it cost us $4,000 every time we started a test kit, and we just couldn't afford to sustain it. So we had to shut it down a couple months ago. So the acute infection in this, in our terminology, is defined as a negative HIV rapid test, positive RNA, and negative or indeterminable Western blot. And recent is defined as new diagnosis with a negative test in the past 6 months. And those were our 911 responses. What that means from a programmatic perspective is our DIS get paged when we have one of these identified. And this harkens those of you that are old enough to remember to the early days of penicillin-resistant gonorrhea when we had pagers and we actually thought we were going to stop the spread of that infection as opposed to changing the treatment modality, which is what we now do. So this I'm going to talk just a little bit more about the analysis that we did for the 2007-2008 cases of HIV in Colorado. We had 26 acute cases, 47 recent, using those definitions that I just had up, and 96 defined as recent based on STARS testing. Of those, 87% were males, same as we've seen in the past, 13% in females. The racial distribution and ethnic distribution in our population doesn't change much from year to year. It's primarily the same affected population. It's mostly white, non-Hispanic, men who have sex with men. When you look at the rates, it obviously is disproportional, but the actual cases are distributed very similarly. And the risk factors are primarily men who have sex with men. Just a few items or a little bit of information about what those characteristics of those men are. This being a STD conference, I want to point this out too. We're using this data to determine some programmatic response. So 44% were diagnosed with an STI within the last 2 years, and 24% of those were gonorrhea. We don't have a lot of gonorrhea in the state of Colorado, about 3,500 cases a year. So it's a marker event. And here's one of the things that our programmatic people struggle with. A lot of bathhouse interaction and internet interaction in these new cases. Now, this is contrasted with the long-standing infections where far fewer are diagnosed with gonorrhea, far fewer met their partners in bathhouses, far fewer met their partners over the internet. So it's a different subset of the population and causes us great concern. In the female cases, which we had a very small number relatively speaking, it was primarily heterosexual risk, and a large number, and I know this is constant across the country, a large number with no identified risk. The characteristics of the female cases are a little bit different distribution, a little younger population, and the STI effect is a little different, but a significant difference is that African American women are grossly disproportionately affected. So we're using this data to develop a different intervention strategy, which is that males who are identified with gonorrhea and we know their risk to be men who have sex with men are going to take a different priority in our intervention strategies. And we also are looking at enhancing our counseling for younger persons with STI because we're seeing those folks identify or be diagnosed later with HIV. Finally, we get to the maps. I want to talk about the maps a little bit. And I only have two here, so this will be fairly quick. You heard some discussion about masking of data, and we continue to be somewhat concerned. You can see that that we put some warnings on here, some informational items. Dots do not represent actual locations of individuals. When we first create these maps, they're marked as preliminary data, and then they're eventually approved for distribution. You can see that the method used here is a proportional symbol census tract method. So the number of cases in the census tract are represented by the size of these dots, and they're within the census tract. This is in the metropolitan area, the Denver metropolitan area. How many of you are from states with frontier areas? So generally we classify Colorado into urban, rural, and frontier. Frontier means is a very, very low population, like one of our counties has less than 500 persons. Do any of you have any frontier counties?
Less than 500.
Less than 500, yes. So you can see, if you think about this, the quandary with putting a dot in a frontier county. And it doesn't really matter how many of these little notes you put on your maps, how many different ways you describe the masking technique you used. There are times in a frontier county where that dot could be right on someone's home or on their piece of property that's thousands of acres, and there's only one home on the piece of property. We have a high level of concern about that issue in Colorado. In the urban area, and I just generally without the actual markers to help me out here, the landmarks, there's a 9 square mile area around our capital that represents 90% of the syphilis in the state of Colorado and about 70% of the HIV in the state of Colorado. If you put dots in the 9 square mile area, we have no concern about that because of the population density. But the further you get away from that, the higher our level of concern about the ability to protect confidentiality. And it's true across the board. And then the second map, we use it some different technology here and use the shading technology, which is really beneficial. But we also use some dots to indicate, which are also, it's also clearly noted at the bottom, this map contains modified case points to protect patient confidentiality. I don't think anybody specifically talked about modified case points, but what that means is that we've used software to make those dots specifically not be at a site, a geocoded site. So they're, wherever they landed, they're absolutely not on one of those residences of a reported case. Again, I'm concerned about whoever the consuming audience is, and I don't really care whether it's our partners at local public health or someone in the public that gets a hold of this. We're very concerned about their interpretation of those dots. The dots are used to represent their risk factors and the venues that they might have been exposed at as identified by them. So I want to talk just a little bit. Those are some concerns we have. We are generating these maps and looking at them internally. So one of the projects that we did that's not been released and will not be released is we looked at foreign-born persons who are HIV positive, and we were looking at it from a care perspective. So we wanted to determine if persons who don't, English is not their first language, could access care that was culturally appropriate for them by using geocoding. Well, some of you would know the answer to this without looking, but what we discovered, this is kind of a no-brainer, is immigrants live in the same places. So they like to live close together. So our map became a cluster. And we could have done that without geocoding. You know, some of you are old enough to have remembered push pins on paper maps. This is just a really a more sophisticated way to do this. However, we do have a different project in play that's partially related to this one, where we looked at the disproportional effect on minority populations in Colorado of STI, particularly HIV also, and started kind of contemplating from a little bigger picture view about how we could use this data to target our resources, and came to the conclusion that we're really too small of a piece of the puzzle in public health to make that make sense. So we went to our Office of Health Disparities director and asked him to take the lead for the department and use our geospatial data and other geospatial data from other programs in the department and use that to market at the department level a department-wide effort to reach out to those most affected populations. My colleague from Virginia used some poverty data, and we all know this, but what we're going to see is in those lower income neighborhoods, every public health issue has a disproportional effect. So our hope here is that we get some pooling of funds to be able to actually do something besides complain about it and get some support at the department level, and we believe that we can, to do some pilot projects within those populations. Once we overlay all of our data, all of us will be comfortable with it being displayed geospatially because the map will be so full, there'll be no way to identify specific subsets of the population. So anyway, that's my short presentation. Mel Mattson is our surveillance program manager, and she really is responsible for this data. I'm just here presenting it for her because we have travel restrictions like many of you do. So that's her contact information. Thank you.
Just want to thank everyone for putting these presentations together today. We'll take questions. And I'm going to repeat the question for the recording. So anyone has one? Yes, Jeff.
It's kind of a question and a comment, so sorry.
Okay. Do you wanna come up to the mic?
No.
Come on.
I think there were a couple of comments made that I think are very important from a GIS standpoint. And you know, Paul's alluding to the fact that you know sometimes we have counties that have extremely low population denominators. And then we have areas that have very high population denominators, and you know they're legitimate concerns and things we really have to take into account. But from your all standpoint, that's kind of where the question comes in. I wonder how much discussion there is right now in the potentially revised confidentiality standards about inclusion of data at census tract levels. And I say that because you know we've been doing it county level for a very long time. And we actually do, now someone correct me if I'm wrong, I know at least from an STD standpoint, we do report data at the zip code level to CDC. It's been done that way forever. We don't report it out from CDC because zip codes are usually just bad. I mean, the data is not good, right? I mean, that's correct. So the data is reported out from CDC at the county level, and that's kind of where we think it should be, but that's not really true. If you had good zip code level data, you may actually report it, right? So we do have data at lower levels of granularity that just aren't reported out. And I suppose my question and concern is more about that census tract level data. You know, the lower the granularity of geographic information, the better public health data we have. And I'd like to think that we don't get, you know, marred down in thinking that 100,000 population is something we should really do. Because I would tend to think, even if 500, I still think that's high, personally. But, you know, let's just be really liberal and say there were, you know, 100 white males in here, you know, and one of us were said to have HIV, you know. Have we really done something wrong from a data confidentiality standpoint? Have we invaded a line that we shouldn't do? And I know they're tough questions, but, you know, if you guys have alluded to that, that'd
be
great.
Yes. So the smallest county, I think, is in the country is like 64 people or something like that. So we figured we'd start with analyzing the census data with our HIV surveillance data at the county level because it would, that one county has one census tract. So the census tracts make up counties. So kind of, in some ways, it's easy to do. We're thinking we started with like numbers like 20 as the smallest denominator, and then we did 100 and 300 and 500. And so we weren't necessarily thinking county as being going to limit us, but we figured we'd just look at the county data because it was easiest, and that's what we have. And then use these suppression rules and find out what we lose with the data at these numbers. So we're starting with that idea of actually like a population level and thinking we've actually had a bunch of people in a room and just given them basically a scenario like that and said, so what are you comfortable with? Because there's all the proof that you can show with the data and say, look, you really can't find this person, but there's also that gut feeling that's intangible and we can't really like put our finger on it. And trying to get that from the community level, how do you really address that? So we're doing all the numbers and we're thinking like 500 as maybe a smallest number, but then we still have to get at that aspect of proximity and small populations like the, what does NHOPE stand for?
Native Hawaiian Other Pacific Islanders.
Yes, the Native Hawaiian Other Pacific Islanders. Those tend to be really small in certain states and or census tracts. So would you just suppress certain groups, or would you start aggregating and saying, okay, if I'm going to show this, I have to combine and do an other category, or I have to do 10-year age to do this, but I could still show census tract level data. I just have to start manipulating these other things and think about what specifics I can get into. And so you might only in the end be able to say male, female, and we just really haven't gotten to that final point, but we aren't thinking 100,000. We think that's ridiculous.
I can add something there, because again, Sathana's been out. She's sadly for her missed a couple of these meetings. But really what Ralph was saying is something we've looked, and I'm not really a numbers person anyway. I'm not a quantitative, even though I do GIS, I'm not a statistician, I'm not a quantitative person, I'm a qualitative person. So we've looked at the numbers and we've had the numbers crunched. But we also have had those conversations, like you were saying, the whole idea of frontier. We have thought, well, maybe there's this county, but all of this certain subpopulation lives here. You know, so whether it's a minority group or whether it's, you know, whatnot, what if they all live in the same place? So it could be you're looking, there's say, 100 NHOPEs in Vermont, but they're all in this county, or they're all in even a finer scale than that. So, you know, we've had those discussions as well, not just the number discussions. And the other thing I wanted to mention, and I forgot to in my presentation, is Pat Sweeney will actually be talking about this more at the CSTE conference. So it's not like our work group is going to come up with this and that's just going to be it. She's going to kind of roll this out for input and discussions at the CSTE conference. And so at that point, we are going to have something kind of in writing and that we kind of feel pretty happy about, but then it's going to be open for input. And so, like Donna mentioned, we did bring in some of our colleagues around CDC and their ideas of what was secure.
20 to infinity.
So that was the first thing we did. And then, so we asked for that up front, and then we had this, you know, maybe half an hour discussion, and then asking them to come up with their numbers again. And I think someone was still at 20, but the infinities had both dropped, and their numbers were much lower. And so that's where we've been doing all these data runs. Like Donna said, we've looked at numerators of, I want to say the smallest that we did was 50. And then, like she said, we did 50, we looked at 100, and we were looking at, you know, how many cases do we lose? So if the suppression denominator is 500, you know, do we start losing all these cases and all these counties? But yes, we are still thinking about census tracts, but we're just, shoot, we started looking at the county level, and then we thought, oh my gosh, you know, what about the state level? So then we went up to the state level and realized they were actually, you know, could be some issues there, you know, depending on what the denominator ended up being. Then we actually stepped back and looked at the whole national level, and there were certain subpopulations. If you look at, say, NHOPEs, 50 to 55 males, it's a pretty small number. But we also thought, well, we're talking about the whole country, so that person probably can't be identified. And so then we started moving our way back down the geographic scale and looked at the state. And then we kind of worked through all of that. And we just were doing the MSA stuff the last couple of weeks. And then we're hoping to move into counties in the next, I think, the next meeting. Yeah. So does that provide a little bit more background?
Can I say one other thing?
Yeah.
And I don't know if we were clear about it, but we weren't saying like the county had to be 500 people. We were saying that the subgroup, whatever you actually planned to present, that was your denominator that we would start with.
Can I give an example?
Yeah.
This is not an STI HIV example, but let me give you an example that happened in Iowa. Real live example. First West Nile death in Iowa. They printed in the paper that the state health department announced it was an elderly male in western Iowa. That's as specific as it got. The reporters searched the obits for western Iowa. Within the next day, they had the guy's name, age, all those details in the Des Moines Register. So that's the balance that we have to look for, is where are those lines, and how can we get useful data out without breaching that?
Debbie? Does anyone else have anything else around the security and confidentiality that we want to? Okay, we can move on. Debbie? So for the SDH data, we have used the 2000 because we wanted to look at certain things that weren't in the updates. And so to go with a standardized data set, we did 2000. But if we were only going to look at like race, age, and things like that, we could use whatever the most current update is. But in the end, we want to do like a much bigger and robust analysis. So we're going to use the 2000. Now, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. I think I am. There was like there went out to all of the states recently. Is that right? Anybody know where I'm going? No. Okay, I'm not going to say that then. but in the future, if more data were to come out nationally, we would want to use the updated census as soon as that data came available. Sorry. Yes?
I'm from a local health department, so census tract level data is what's most useful for us. But what I find is having issues with what to use as the numerator, because it is a census tract, it's Nashville, Tennessee. So we're familiar with gonorrhea within a year's time. In most instances, we have a large enough numerator where a rate can be calculated, but what I'm concerned about is it a sound methodology to aggregate case counts for years, but what would I use as the denominator then?
Okay, so, yeah. So let me try to repeat the question. It's what, if you don't know what size numerator or what size denominator? Both. Both. Okay, for in a local area, you're looking at census tract level. If you're aggregating, what size to use and
or what year?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Actually, that's an incredibly good question, and there are a couple of things that are caught up in that question. If you have fairly small numerators and you have a fairly large denominator, even in a given year, you can have a great deal of rate instability when you calculate that rate. So we generally have been looking at calculating a relative standard error, and any standard error over 30%, we sort of say this rate really isn't stable enough to present. So that's when we begin looking at aggregating across years. And that's where you need good census data for the years that match the numerators that you're aggregating. And we actually calculate an average, a three-year average, which is an average population and an average numerator value across that time period. And then again, look at the relative standard error, and if it's really quite volatile, we would still say add another couple of years to it. But programmatically, within your jurisdiction, it's still very worthwhile to look at the absolute numbers in any given year in a census tract, because that's a neighborhood that you can actually target. And if you have people working, DIS working that neighborhood, the rate may not be terribly useful to them. So actually knowing the number of cases could be quite useful.
For us, what we have available are two data sets. One is when we get census population estimates at the census tract level from census. So the most recent that's available is 2000. Well, we also have access to ClearCop data,
yep.
But we only get it at intermittent years. So what I find is, you know, I'll have, of course, you know, surveillance data. So I have numerator data. I can, you know, aggregate as much as I want, but that population denominator I'll have, you know, maybe year 2000 by census tract, 2007 by census tract. So if I'm aggregating years in the numerator, how do I aggregate?
Right. The question is if you only have a couple of points for your numerator or your denominator data, say you have 2000, 2007, you might have a 2009 projection, but then you're aggregating from 2006 through 2008. There are a couple of different ways that I've dealt with that in the past. In Excel, I actually use SAS for it, but in Excel there's a macro that will do a linear projection. So if you have a number of known points, you just apply a linear projection to that, and it will give you the missing years in between. It's a way of estimating. It may not be the most accurate way. Also, if you have data for previous years, say you have census data for 2000, that's the actual count, then you have a Claritas estimate for 2006, you can extrapolate on a line as well. So you can fill in a missing data point beyond the range of what you have. And that's a good estimate. Again, always look at your relative standard error in those, because that's another potential, you're introducing another potential source of error in your calculation of rates. But you can certainly do it, and if you go in the Excel help linear projection, it'll show you how to set up just like that.
Cheers. Yeah.
We can hijack the rest of this thing. Talk about coffee and jelly. In your work group again, and going back to what Paul was showing on his slides and should always show, anytime we've got points on there, we should include caveats that we'd use some kind of randomization process to offset the points. Right? And you know, there's been publications by John Brownstein and colleagues out of Harvard that have showed that, you know, even in peer-reviewed publications for New England Journal in particular, that's who he picked on, that they had 19 publications over the course of about 10 years that had data that was point locations that were not offset, and he identified a large amount of those by going in and using GIS to do it. So doing that is great. So, but my question is, from a confidentiality standpoint, if we wanted to use 500 as the denominator, if that became our golden rule, right, say at the census tract level, how do we deal with that if we want to use offsets, right? So even if you're offsetting the data at the census tract level, you know, would we think from a confidentiality guideline standpoint that you still need to use denominators? You know, you do to a degree. I agree, like you were saying, in your frontier area. But you know, do we use offsets in combination with, or is 500 still the denominator for that? Or do we use a different denominator because we have offset the data? So, you know, it gets very complicated, but I don't know if that's come up at all.
We have, we haven't gotten there, and really the geographic, actually like displaying it geographically is something we haven't even really gotten to in the work group. We're still talking about like tables at this point, and so there wouldn't be, you know, that those issues. Do you have any thoughts on it?
That is a really good question, and I don't have the answer. Right now, when we're talking about these rules, the real interest that Pat has, and I'm guessing Irene has, is that there's a, and Irene Hall is the branch chief of the HCSB. We're leaning towards having a rule that can be applied at all scales just to make it simpler. So if the denominator rule is 100. It's 100 at the state, it's 100 at the MSA, it's 100 at the county. We haven't even talked about census tract level yet. I think that's at least, you know, it's just such a pie in the sky dream right now for us to have census tract level data, except for the special projects that we really, it's not that we're not worried about it or even thinking about it, it's just not the top of the list of developing these rules. I think, in my opinion, just knowing the numbers, either the rule would have to be, the denominator rule would have to be different, or I think the other thing we really got to this week is that, and this might not be answering your question, going in, just instead of doing, you know, race by sex by age, which we might do at the state level at a certain denominator, you might just use two subcategories at the county level and fewer subclasses as you go down the scale. Does that make sense? So it might be a combination of those two things, denominator rule and how much you break the data down into subclass. With the backup of the proportion, yeah. So, and what I meant by that, yeah, was the backup of the proportion would be, so if our denominator rule was, say it's 100, and say a county makes it in, you know, that has 101 people, but if there are
greater than
10% of the population is HIV positive or cases, then even though it passed the denominator rule, that proportion would cause it to be suppressed. Did I explain that very well? In my head, I understand what we're doing. But so that's how that proportion rule comes into play. So even though you might have a substantial population, if for some reason there's a real epidemic there and that proportion of the population is higher than 10%, then that would be suppressed as well, because there would be concerns that, okay, there's 101 people, 20 of them have HIV. You know, then you might can start to figure out. So we've talked a lot about that, you know, how the proportion works.
And really, we're not going to be showing data at the national, at the CDC, at like those point level data. And so that's really going to still be something that is going to come from you, like what your state is comfortable with, what it makes sense at your state, and we're not going to tell you how to use your data. And obviously, you're probably going to have much more flexibility than we do. And we'll be much more strict with the data and anything that we would release. So,
and the maps that I've made so far from the project for Colorado and Virginia and Washington, if I remember correctly, I haven't done any point level maps. You know, moving, you know, perturbing the points or not. All my maps have been choropleth with the shades or some other types of maps. So the only dot maps I've ever made have been the national level. You know, those animated dot maps of AIDS that are online. So, yeah.
And just to be clear, Kim, we have not sent you longitude and latitude data.
Right.
No, I've only sent census tract.
Yes.
Yeah. And even when we share these maps, so I'll make maps and I'll want Donna to see them or some of her colleagues in Hixby, we don't email those maps across the internet because it's sensitive data. It's the same as a table. And so I'll put them on our secure network and I'll email, you know, whoever I want to look at them. Okay, they're there. Take a look. So, you know, we're still protecting the data in the same manner. Just
right. Right. Yeah. If we print them out, we still shred them right after. Yeah. So, not many people have seen the maps from our project. any other questions? All right. Well, thank you all for coming, and hope you enjoyed the conference.
Yes, thanks for coming.